How's your life going? Even if you're doing pretty well, it's only a matter of time before you have to face some inevitable challenges. Illness, loss, death. The downsides of existence are not optional, but your attitude to them is. Stephen Petro offers a broad perspective in his book, The Joy You Make, Find the Silver Linings Even on Your Darkest Days. Stephen is an award-winning journalist and author who's written essays for The Washington Post, New York Times, and NPR. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
Hello, this is Stephen Petro, and I'm the author of The Joy You Make, Find the Silver Linings Even on Your Darkest Days. I'm also known for my columns and essays about aging, health, and civility in The Washington Post and The New York Times. I'm excited to have been selected to participate in the next Big Idea Club, and I'm going to share with you five of the key insights from my book. Insight number one, we don't really understand what joy is. That included me at the outset. Like many, I conflated joy with happiness, its shinier first cousin. Wrong, I came to understand. Joy is more self-sustaining and gratifying than happiness. One way I like to describe this difference is to think of happiness as a sugary Twinkie, with joy more like a whole wheat muffin. The Twinkie boosts your glucose level, resulting in a sugar high, and then you crash. The healthier muffin is metabolized more slowly, with no big highs or lows, leaving you satisfied for a longer time. Others, like the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu, agreed with me. Well, actually, I should say, I support their perspective, as they wrote pointedly in The Book of Joy. Joy is much bigger than happiness, while happiness is often seen as being dependent on external circumstances. Joy is not. Or as a fellow journalist, Adela Rogers St. John wrote many years ago now, joy is a light that fills you with hope and faith and love. In my book, I give some examples of the differences between happiness and joy. Here are two. Happiness is eating a fudge brownie. Joy is making a pan of brownies to share. Happiness is learning you've gone into remission, or better yet, been cured. Joy is holding the hand of a loved one going through a challenging illness, even if they don't get well. Insight number two. You can build, cultivate, truth be told, you can make your own joy. I confess in the introduction to my book that one of my nicknames is Eeyore, the gloomy jackass in the Winnie the Pooh series. That's to say, I've long been a half-glass-empty kind of guy. To boot, I've long felt something was missing from my life. I've struggled to feel more joyful, to be more joyful, sometimes chasing it, sometimes despairing of ever finding it, other times too lost or in the dark to see it right in front of me. Then, in the midst of the pandemic, a study was published by the University of Michigan showing that a whopping 83% of adults over 50 had felt some or a lot of joy since the official beginning of the shutdown. Wow. That knocked me in the head, as it did one of the study's researchers, Jessica Finley, who acknowledged her surprise in the findings, explaining to me, it's not a monolithic story of decline or loss. People are finding silver linings in this time and are resilient to what they're experiencing. What she was really saying is that joy is always present in the everyday world, in our memories, in our relationships, and within ourselves. I remember saying to myself, if the people in this study can find joy in the darkness, I can too. Or so I hoped. For starters, it takes a mind shift, say from being gloomy Eeyore to Tigger, the outgoing and cheerful Tiger, also a Pooh character. At least that's what many of the experts I interviewed told me. They included psychologists, social scientists, religious leaders, ethicists, and others. Shifting our perspective can help us see anew. This starts with creating an awareness of the good things in our lives. If you're at all like me, it's so much easier to focus and obsess on our challenges, troubles, even failures. But when I began to make a conscious effort to focus on the positive, I began to see myself differently. I began to see my relationships differently. Sometimes even the larger world around me looked different, more hopeful. Meanwhile, scholars like Robert Emmons, a psychologist whose work is in the field of positive psychology, have produced a body of research supporting how we can change our mindsets. Rather than let my awareness of things brighter and more beautiful evaporate into the ether, I followed the advice of Emmons, who suggests keeping a record like a daily gratitude journal. I know that sounds a bit woo-woo, but it's really just a notebook. When I first started keeping the gratitude journal, I feared I'd come up empty-handed. But even on the day my father died, I found three things to jot down in my little brown notebook. 1, the support of my siblings. 2, the peace I hope my father had now found. I had to stretch a bit. 3, the chocolate ice cream that neighbors brought over. The next step might be the most important one, however. Sharing your gratitude, like saying thank you to the person who holds a door open for you, calling a friend to tell them why you're grateful for the friendship, or just doing something for someone. Bake some muffins, buy some flowers, sweep their steps. Which takes me to insight number 3, sharing your joy can have unexpected consequences. This is a story I love. Several years ago, I was waiting in line at my favorite bakery for my favorite pastry, a peach scone. On this particular Sunday, I joined a long line that reached out onto the sidewalk. Finally, with just one person ahead of me, I noticed that only one perfect peach scone remained. My scone. I heard the woman in front of me say, "I'll have a chocolate croissant." My scone was saved for me, hurrah! And I quickly advanced and pointed to the lone scone, saying, "I'll take that." Not 1 second later, the fellow behind me, a complete stranger and cyclist wearing tight lycra, shouted, "That's my scone. I've been waiting in line for 20 minutes. What? I thought to myself. He's got a lot of nerve to tell me how long he's been in line when he's actually behind me. I stood there for what seemed an eternity, but didn't claim ownership or tell him to go fuck off. Instead, after that pause, I turned, looked him in the eye, and asked, "Would you like half?" I shocked myself. I had actually been practicing the technique of taking what's sometimes called a sacred pause, which is meant to help develop a new habit to fall back on when provoked. Wait, settle, and speak. Jack Kornfield, the Buddhist teacher, had once explained, "In a moment of stopping, we break the spell between past result and automatic reaction. When we pause, we can notice the actual experience, the pain or pleasure, fear or excitement. In the stillness before our habits arise, we can become free to act wisely." Okay, back to the potential scone stealer. Once I'd made my offer, I saw befuddlement cross his face. He took a moment before responding, a pause of his own, and then accepted my proposal, sweetening the deal. "Why don't I buy another pastry and we can share both of them?" He did, and we did. We took our goods and sat down on a nearby bench where we chatted for about half an hour. At first blush, I'd say we had pretty much nothing in common. But that would be based on assumptions, like those skinny lycra shorts he sported, and would be wrong. He'd actually gotten up early, hoping to get to the bakery before the scones ran out. But he had a flat tire, making him late. Later that day, reflecting on what had taken place, I realized we'd shared a sweet moment of connection. But actually more than that, we'd recognized each other, and by that I mean we saw and listened to each other. Instead of saying, "Would you like half?" I might as well have said, "You matter." And vice versa. I realized that our ability to become vulnerable had allowed us to bridge the social isolation and loneliness that many experts believe gins up mistrust, anger, and polarization, leading us to be withdrawn, rageful, and even more lonely. Insight number 4, joy is contagious. At the bakery, it turns out I experienced what's known as a helper's high, or what Melanie Rudd, an associate professor of marketing at the University of Houston, calls the boost we get from being kind. Not surprisingly, Rudd told me that once we experience that high, which comes from behaving in a kind or generous manner, we want more of it. As she wrote in Scientific American, volunteer work is associated with more joy and less depression. Even people who spend money on others rather than themselves experience greater feelings of joyfulness. I really never thought that someone else's good behavior might rub off on me, although it's not hard to see how bad behavior is often copycatted. Then I remembered waiting to buy coffee the week before my scone-sharing interaction. The customer in front of me, whom I didn't know, told the barista that he'd pay for my beverage. After I said it wasn't necessary, he told me he just does that from time to time. It makes me feel good. I thanked him profusely, feeling as if I had been given a gift much more expensive than one that had cost $3.24, the cost of that cup of coffee. I also wondered, was my willingness to share a scone some days later related to this gift of coffee? Possibly. Indeed, joy is often contagious. You just need the right circumstances. Sisters matter too. Which takes me to insight number 5, joy and sorrow can exist simultaneously. As I've said, my earnest search for joy began the year Julie learned she had cancer. It wasn't a conscious decision, but one born of necessity. How could I deal with her suffering? How could I prepare to let her go, if and when the time came? I had to find some crumbs of joy, if only to make it through 2,000-plus days, remembering what Thomas Aquinas had long ago said, "Man cannot live without joy." 3 months before her death, Julie asked for a birthday party. Of course, we told her, although 61 is not a traditional milestone birthday. 4 days before the party, we learned that Julie had exhausted all legitimate treatment options. Our planned celebration quickly morphed into a combined birthday bash and, I don't know, what should I call it, a going away party. Joy and sorrow, celebration and grief. How do we simultaneously hold such seemingly opposed emotions? Returning to the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Tutu, it is they who recognize that it's possible for us to be joyful even in the face of our daily struggles, whether it's a flat tire, a job loss, a broken marriage, or serious illness. The Archbishop noted, even as he was suffering from prostate cancer, "We are fragile creatures, and it is from this weakness, not despite it, that we discover the possibility of true joy." In the midst of Julie's illness, I interviewed Charles Matthews, a professor of religious studies at the University of Virginia. I asked him directly about the mystery I felt about experiencing joy and sorrow simultaneously. He told me that joy is not only an emotion that leaves you particularly giddy, but that it renders the world more vivid, more vibrant to you. Joy can be amplified in the moment when there are other people experiencing the same thing as you. It's the reverberating or communal responses with each other that can make such a difference and can help us experience joy at a time when we might ordinarily think there is none. The evening before Julie died, my brother, sister, and I texted each other, all from within the same house. I started, "Good night, Sibs." Jay, "Good night." Then Julie, "Good night to the best big brothers in the whole world." Then Jay again, "Love you to the moon and back." And me, "And to the bestest sister ever." As I fell asleep, I thought, how lucky am I? How awful is this? Joy and sorrow, each so vivid, each amplifying the other, each holding me. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you find or create more joy in your own life and those around you. I'm Stephen Petro.
Thank you, Stephen. That was Stephen Petro with 5 big ideas from The Joy You Make. Find the silver linings even on your darkest days. Also check out our book bite for Stephen's previous book, Stupid Things I Won't Do When I Get Old, a highly judgmental, unapologetically honest accounting of all the things our elders are doing wrong. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.